You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Happy New Year, everyone. It's 2017 as of the day that this episode comes out, January 1st. I am actually recording this on New Year's Eve. I have the taste of cock on my lips, a bottle of cider next to me, a little negligee on. I've been having a very good New Year's Eve. And I decided that this first episode of 2017 should just be you and me. And so here we are. I have so many emails from all of you that I'm so excited about. And I have actually an expert who felt so moved by a previous listener's email that she recorded a very personal response. So you'll be hearing that later. And also my own confession. We are going to be featuring listener confessions in 2017. And of course, the theme for January is firsts. I want your stories. You can either call and leave me a voicemail, you can record it yourself and email me the MP3, or you can type it out and I will read it on your behalf. All of the details are on the episode page for this episode, which is 142. And I want your firsts. And it doesn't have to be traditional firsts. It doesn't have to be firsts like the first time you had intercourse or the first time you had an orgasm. It can be. But also firsts like the first time you realized you weren't amazing at sex, or the first time you realized that you were asexual, or that relationships weren't for you, or that your body was actually more amazing than you thought it was. So get creative with your firsts, but I want your confessions. So you can find all of the details about how to submit those to me on sexgetsreal.com/EP142 for episode 142. And let's dive in. So because confessions are going to be a theme and a way for me to get your voice on the podcast and your very personal stories on the podcast, first of all, I just want to make sure you know, if you want to hear the future themes for the rest of the year, you just need to make sure you're on the Sex Gets Real newsletter. So you can sign up on the Sex Gets Real website for that. February will be announced in the next couple of weeks. So if you don't have a first you want to share, then stay tuned for February's theme. But I was just at my mom's house for Christmas, and we were helping her clear out a whole bunch of storage and getting rid of a whole bunch of junk. And because of that, we found boxes full of things that were mine from my childhood, including one of my diaries. And this diary was for part of middle school and a little bit into my freshman year of high school. And I found this really sweet journal entry that I wrote. It was my freshman year of high school, November 14th, 1992, and it's a journal post about my very first real kiss. And so I thought I would read that to you. I was, 14. I had just turned 14, and the boy that's in the story was a senior in high school, so he must have been 17. And it really had an impact on me, which I think you will pick up from my 14-year-old perspective. So let me share with you what happened. Last night was Friday the 13th and Pam's birthday party. Everyone was there. I slow danced with Kevin, John, and Chris. The best one was with John. Around 10:30 p.m., I got sick and had to lay down in Pam's mom's room. John came in and held my hand and talked to me. We talked about everything. When I was finally feeling better and I got up, everyone was already in the hot tub, but I was the only one without a swimsuit besides John. So we curled up in the house alone, and that's underlined, and talked. He is so confused and hurt, I can't even begin to explain it. He was having some girl problems, I think. I asked him if he wanted a hug, and he did. We hugged very tightly for about 5 minutes. When we pulled apart, our arms stayed wrapped around each other, and our faces were just inches apart. He got this dreamy look in his eyes, and I realized he was staring at my mouth. He sort of smiled at me, and then he started closing his eyes and moving forward. I did the same, but I was scared shitless. Our lips touched, and his tongue opened my mouth, just like in the movies. His tongue touched mine, and we kissed, that's in all caps, for a long time. When we finally stopped, I was shaking like an 8.0 earthquake. He held me to his chest, and then all of a sudden he pulled away and started apologizing over and over again. I told him he couldn't hurt me to help him calm down, but I know he could break me so easily. I have never felt so confused or scared in my whole life. Just think, my very first kiss. Yay! I think. I'm still shaking from it, and it's 24 hours later. I didn't get any sleep. At around 4 a.m., I laid down on Pam's bed because I was worrying myself sick. John came in, and I crawled into his lap and told him how scared I was. I'm not sure he understood, though. We sat like that until my mom came to pick me up around 8 a.m. When I walked out the door, I turned and said goodbye and hugged him. I hope it wasn't the last time that we'll share a special moment together. If it was, I want to remember it for eternity. I was feeling so sleepy and weird that I stayed home today. I haven't eaten for 24 hours, but I'm not even hungry at all. I'd probably puke it up all anyway. Besides all this, Pam's party was great. I learned how to fast dance. We played fun games and had neat food to eat. Now I know why none of the grown-ups that I know want to go back to being a teenager. It's so confusing and emotional. I also know why it's called the best of times and the worst of times. It is. Like, I told John everything would work itself out and we would all be okay, but I'm really not sure. I hope it does. John told me to call him if I feel sad. He said he cares for me. Maybe if I cry, I'll feel better. I hope when I'm older, I can laugh at this entry and know what was going on. I better go now. Dawn. John and I actually ended up dating for about 3.5 months my freshman year of high school, and he gave me a lot of my firsts. He was the first to touch my breasts over my clothes, and funny enough, I didn't even know it, but that's another story for another day. And we went to our first winter formal, but the one thing that stands out to me is I remember so clearly when he kissed me that I had all of these sensations in my body that I wasn't prepared for. I had no idea that kissing someone went beyond just your lips touching, and I really wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for the enormous sensations that I felt in my body. And it was so scary and super confusing. John was actually a really, really, really sweet first boyfriend. But I just thought that that was such an interesting, sweet, innocent little post from my 14-year-old self about my first kiss. So if you have any confessions, and they don't have to be touching or heartfelt, they can be angry or full of regret or shame, please share those with me. So I've gotten so many amazing emails from many of you, and I want to just read a couple of them to let you know that I got them. I got an email from Shelby that says, thank you. My friend Dustin turned me on, no pun intended, to your podcast, and I'm so relieved to hear sex talked about without judgment. I'm loving the normality it gives to subjects like kink and anal instead of pretending that they are dirty, terrible things. You're doing an excellent job, and I can't wait to listen to all of the older episodes and be on track with all the new ones you put out. Thanks again, Shelby. Yay, thank you so much, Shelby. I love that you heard about the show from a friend, and thank you to Dustin. I got a text message the other day that said, Dawn, I am a new fan, listener to your show on Spotify, and you fucking rock. Oh my God, the emotions heard in your voice and what that brought up for me on your oppression talk after the election has me falling in love with you as a human being. You are the best, and I am an older guy who obviously missed out on a whole lot of second chakra stuff. So rock on. You are the best. Best wishes for love and great sex. I wish I had your name so I could tell you, but you will hear that and know. I also got an email from someone named Pure Pussy that says, keep it up. I absolutely love your podcast and I'm currently trying to catch up. so much about openness, communication, body and sex positivity, respect and humor that resonates with me. I love the content you get into and the interviews. Your conversations are so important to battle this rape culture we live in. Talking about sex is important, and I don't even have that many friends who are willing. Round of applause and great appreciation to you, Dawn and Dylan. I'm a single poly female-identified lesbian, 90%, and Korean adoptee, culturally Irish, in my late 20s who is exploring kink and poly in New York City and FetLife. I'm also a photographer who wants to create beautiful image with a darker aesthetic. I'm trying to stay patient on this journey and connecting with like-minded people. You have helped me feel a sense of community just by listening and laughing. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Much love and lust. Pure pussy. Oh, thank you so much. This email just like touched me, and I love that you gave the shout out to Dylan. So I will make sure that Dylan also sees this. She is out having all kinds of shenanigans. So yay, Dylan. So I just want to thank all of you. There's so many others. Those are just a handful that I pulled out saying thank you. And I just wanted to make sure that you heard that I had gotten your emails, since I don't almost get back to everybody in a very timely manner. A couple of episodes ago, there was someone who wrote in feeling really terrible about the way that their vulva looked and being worried that the people that she was intimate with were going to be disgusted by the way that her vulva appeared. I actually got an email from someone who had labiaplasty and wanted to kind of talk about it a little bit. And so I'm going to share that. And then immediately after that, Sarah from yaysex.ca, who was on the show last year, was so moved by that email and had a really personal experience to share with her own vulva that she recorded a little response. So I'm going to share Hannah's email about her labiaplasty, and then Sarah is going to share a little about her vulva. So Hannah writes, I stumbled across your podcast and I've listened to a few episodes. I love listening to you. In this note, labiaplasty and yoni egg. So I'm just going to read the labiaplasty for right now. The labiaplasty is a difficult subject to cover. I never thought I'd actually get the procedure. It wasn't anything impulsive. It was something I fought with myself about for years. I felt like it would make me more confident to do all of the fun, sexy time things I wanted, but I was too anxious about because of my labia size. It wasn't bad at all, like 1 centimeter below majora. So she's saying that her inner lips were a little bit bigger than her outer lips. At the same time, isn't that comfort supposed to come from self-love and acceptance and a loving partner? I feel like I cheated myself in a way by getting the procedure, but I did get it. $3,000 for a new pussy. This was probably one of my most traumatic experiences. I lay on the table, knees out, spread eagle, my labia minoras marked up and cleaned for surgery. I looked up at the ceiling while I had the injection nerve block. Then I felt the surgical tools stretching my flesh. Then I felt the incision. Not painful, just the light, dull sensation of tissue being sliced. I could almost hear it. That, on top of the smell of sterile air, put me out. Yes, I fainted after the first or second incision. I woke up to my whole body, especially my legs, shaking. Trauma tremors. I cried a bit and went through the rest of the procedure, but it was awful. I'll never forget that. And I haven't been able to tell anyone because I'm ashamed I even put myself through such hell. Not to mention, it probably makes them self-conscious of their bits. I mutilated myself. For what? Self-esteem issues? Give me a fucking break. Anyway, 5 years later, and I've had a lot of oral sex. I'm much more confident about my bits. I don't care as much either. Through those 5 years, I became an RN, and let's just say bedside care has given me a reality check of bodies, but more importantly, priorities in life. Thanks for reading. Looking forward to listening to more of your podcast, Hannah. Hannah, thank you so much for sharing that. I know that a couple of listeners have written in over the years concerned about their vulva appearance and considering labiaplasty. And I know that way back in the beginning, Dylan and I talked about an article we had read where labiaplasty was becoming a bit of an epidemic in Australia. And so doctors were speaking out about the potential sensation loss and the cost and, the emotional cost, not just the financial cost. So I really appreciate that you were brave enough to share your personal story with us. And I hope that to anybody who is struggling with the way that their vulva looks or their genitals in general, that that might be a perspective they hadn't considered. Now I want to share with you something really wonderful that Sarah shared. And when we come back, emails from all of you.
Hi, Dawn and the Sex Gets Real listeners. I have a message for the listener who called themselves Embarrassed, whose letter you wrote or read in episode 136. This was a listener who had large labia and was embarrassed about them and was asking about whether or not male partners notice or care about the appearance of your labia. I actually have larger internal labia myself. So I have kind of one of those vulvas where I have smaller external labia and my internal labia sort of bloom out. When I was younger and starting to masturbate, I thought that I was actually growing a penis because I hadn't really heard about other girls masturbating and I knew that boys did. So if I'm masturbating, I must be a boy and I must have a penis. This really plagued me, this fear, for a long time. I would explore my vulva really, really anxiously at night, just so nauseous about kind of what I would find in my vulva. I remember the day I realized that I had two of whatever I thought a penis was, and that was really confusing because what I was touching were labia and not a penis. As I became sexually active, my first partner didn't really say anything about my vulva. And thinking that I was really freaky going into that sexual experience, I started to realize that maybe I was more normal than I thought. When I had sex with another woman with a vulva for the first time, I realized that her vulva was very, very different than mine. She had one of those vulvas with larger external labia and smaller internal labia. In fact, she really had no internal labia at all. Seeing her vulva, a vulva that seemed really neat and tidy compared to my vulva, which I perceived as being sloppy or messy, really just brought more shame into my life. And I was really worried about what was wrong with me. I thought there was something wrong with me. After that relationship ended, I started sleeping with male partners again, and I didn't really hear anything about my vulva for a couple of years. And I sort of forgot that I had this self-consciousness about me until I had a partner say that my vulva looked a lot different than his last girlfriend's vulva. Now, being self-conscious, I took that word different to mean bad, but having spoken to that partner since, he assures me that he didn't mean bad, he meant different. Like, she had a vulva with smaller internal labia and I have bigger internal labia. Over the years, I've had a lot of dysphoria about my labia. I've pulled at them, I've thought about cutting them off myself, just out of kind of the panic of really hating a part of your body. I've also looked at surgery and watched documentaries about labiaplasty. And looking back at labiaplasty now, I think it's a good option for people if they're really, really, really uncomfortable with their labia. But it also sort of enforces a culturally informed view of beauty and just reinforces those self-consciousnesses that we already have. There's nothing wrong with a vulva with larger labia. And the way that the doctors in the documentaries I've seen, I haven't actually gone for a consultation, so I can't speak to how doctors actually talk to you. But in the documentaries, they always refer to these surgically enhanced, I guess, surgically altered vulvas as being neat and tidy and clean, which all sort of suggest that vulvas with big internal labia are dirty or messy or sloppy. I have started to think about my self-consciousness more instead of just kind of pushing it away. I've started to tell people that I was self-conscious about my labia. I've actually shown people that I wasn't having sex with my labia. And one of them told me once that she was so just enamored with the way that my vulva looked that it was really hard for her to not just dive right into my genitals. We didn't have that kind of relationship, so it wasn't appropriate for her to do so. In telling people about my self-consciousness, a lot more people have told me that they really like the way my vulva looks and feels and tastes and the texture of it. I found overall that most of my partners either absolutely love my vulva, like to a fetish level, like they just want to put their mouths all over my labia and suck on them. Or my partners really don't notice that there's anything different about my labia at all. So I guess to speak to your question, do men notice or care about the appearance of your vulva? I would say if they do, you should probably dump that person because you're not going to change your vulva and your vulva is beautiful. And that person has taken in those messages from our culture and from porn and from those mean plastic surgeons about what a neat and tidy vulva looks like. And really, that's kind of just a rude thing to do to somebody, to tell them that their vulva is messy or dirty. And you might just find, if you tell somebody about your self-consciousness, they might turn around and tell you that they're a little bit self-conscious about the amount that they love your vulva, that they think it's just the sexiest thing ever and that they have a really hard time keeping themselves off of you. I hope that helps. It's a long journey to get to a place where you can be more comfortable with your vulva. As another side note, I think actually taking more pictures of your genitals can sometimes help. It helps you face your fears and realize some things that you think are sexy about your body. You can also try masturbating in front of a mirror. You can kind of see your vulva in action and maybe get a sense for what it looks like when you're not panicking about what it looks like. Embarrassed, I wish you lots of luck. I send you great big hugs because I know how hard this can be personally. I'm sure your vulva is beautiful, and I hope that you can find some peace with your body.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was amazing, and I love that we were able to share that with the world. You're incredible, and so is your vulva. I have not personally verified this, but I'm just saying. Okay, so I have a whole bunch of listener emails, and some of them are really deep and really intense, and so we're going to jump into a couple of them. The first is from someone who named themselves Left Out, and the subject is why I feel left out of consent conversations. Hi, Dawn. I just got hooked on your podcast. Shout out to Kitty Stryker. Her interview with you got me started. And I love what you're doing with it. I relate so strongly to you and your guests, and I love to hear your joy and pragmatism when it comes to sex. I haven't listened to all of your episodes, and maybe my issue is addressed in one of your earlier ones. If so, please point me in the right direction. I feel left out of conversations about consent. I volunteer for a sex-positive organization. I'm a part of the local kink community. I listen to podcasts like yours and read articles about the consent movement. I'm steeped in it, surrounded by it, and I love that. But my experience is never talked about. I'm allosexual, which means that she is not asexual, so she experiences sexual desire. I'm allosexual and I have a reactive sex drive. Just learning that was a thing was eye-opening to me and really helped me embrace how I experience sexual desire. I don't hunger for it. I'm open to sexual experiences. In fact, I'm a very sexual person, but I don't feel the desire to initiate or pursue sex. In short, I need some convincing, and this is anathema to the affirmative consent mindset. Which I understand. We have a culture that normalizes coercion as a tactic to get sex. And I love the idea that as a culture, community, and movement, we only want people to have experiences that they want, not that they begrudgingly resign themselves to. So in the big picture, I completely agree. Affirmative, enthusiastic, well-informed consent is the best. However, on a more personal scale, I'm having a hard time with it. If my partner waited for me to be fuck yes about my sexual experiences and took a yeah, okay, I guess if you want to as a no, we would never get laid. I just don't work that way. I need someone to get frisky with me, to put their hands on me in just the way I like. Then my motor gets running and fuck yes is on the tip of my tongue. But the idea that we shouldn't even start without the express consent of our partners, and if they seem lukewarm to the idea, back off, just doesn't apply to my experience. I've been told both directly and indirectly that the way I do sex is wrong, that anyone who simply acquiesces to their partner isn't consenting, and anyone who engages with a lukewarm partner is victimizing them. I've been told that I'm being taken advantage of, that my partners are monsters or manipulators or rapists in waiting. I've been told that the only people who are exempt from this fuck yes model are asexual or sex averse. Basically, that it's all or nothing. I guess what I'm looking for here is a bit of visibility and permission to have my preferences. I know I'm not the only one who feels this way, and maybe someone else will hear this and realize that they weren't alone. I would also love to hear your thoughts on how to explain this to people who are steeped in sex positivity and consent culture. Usually, I have to start from the ground up. It's been successful so far. I have had great partners. But since my way is left out of the narrative, I'm always starting from the very beginning. Thanks for all you do. Sincerely, Left Out. What a wonderful, articulate email. Thank you so much, Left Out. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing your experiences and your stories so that we can have this conversation. I love that you know that you have responsive desire. Hopefully, you have checked out Emily Nagoski's Come As You Are book. Hopefully, you also follow her blog, The Dirty Normal. There's so much in the book and the blog about responsive desire, how our brains work, the accelerators and the brakes, what turns us on, what turns us off, or keeps us from feeling desire. So for anyone who is struggling with sexual desire, that can be a really, really wonderful place to start. Emily's research is fantastic and paradigm changing for the sex education world. And so Left Out, I hope that you already have that resource, but if you don't, that might be a wonderful place to start and also to give you some new language around what you're experiencing. So like anything, when it comes to consent, there's a lot of nuance. And you said that we live in a culture where consent is not the norm, right? So we live in rape culture. We live in a culture that has hyper-toxic masculinity, which is a model that teaches boys and men to move forward until they get a no or until they're stopped. And that also teaches women and girls that sex will be taken from them unless they stop it. And so that creates a really unhealthy, dangerous dynamic that we're all swimming in. And then, of course, the cultural stories around us just reinforce all of those messages. Much like the diary entry that I just shared, you know, we're taught that taking a kiss without asking for it first is the way that we're supposed to do these things. And so the counterculture to that are these folks who, including myself, who are very consent-centric, right? So all of the interactions that we should be having should be based around consent. And consent gets a bad rap a lot of times, but really what consent means is just having the social skills to be able to communicate with people, right? So the words, the body language, the facial expressions, the nuance of what is this person communicating to me? Have I asked permission to engage with their body or with them? And have I received that permission back? So a lot of the consent conversations that we have, because we live in this terrible rape culture and this terrible model that teaches all of us broken ways of relating, tends to be pretty black or white and pretty basic. But of course, consent has tons of nuance, which, because you heard about the show from Kitty Stryker, you know that there's so many facets to consent that don't ever get talked about. Kitty was talking about, can you truly consent to sex work if sex work is what pays your mortgage? So you don't have the choice to not do it. You know, even if you're saying yes to what's happening, is that really a yes? If saying no means you're homeless, so then you can't really say no. Same about potentially losing jobs, or the same about, you know, certain cultural dynamics that exist in the world. Consent looks very different in different religious communities, in different cultures around the world than it does in kind of Western white culture, right? So the first thing I want to say is your responsive desire is super normal. In fact, as you'll see from Emily's research, something like 70 or 80% of women, and I'm not going to specify cis or trans because that didn't really come up in the research, so I'm just going to say women, that like 70 or 80% of women have responsive desire. And of course, since then, Emily's done additional research around men and found that a high percentage of men actually have responsive desire as well. So the spontaneous desire is something that exists in a much smaller percentage of us and is also highly contextual. So we're more likely to have spontaneous desire when we're falling in love with someone and we're in that super high oxytocin phase versus later when those love hormones have kind of worn off. And so we're kind of settling back into our routines and our normal life, right? So here are some of the things that I want you to think about. Consent is about making sure that the people that are interacting with each other have a complete understanding of the consequences, what's at stake, what might happen, and that they're choosing it for themselves. So you can, it's super valid to express to a partner that you don't generally experience sexual desire unless some type of stimulus has presented itself. Now, I do want to invite you to experiment with stimulating yourself. So I have responsive desire, and sometimes I will look at someone super sexy and I'm just ready to take off all my clothes. But for the most part, when I'm just like going around my day, I'm in my relationship with Alex and, you know, we're doing our normal stuff. Like, I don't feel like having sex in those situations. So something has to happen that then tells my body, maybe this is a time to feel sexy. One of the ways that I do that is if I've noticed that I haven't really felt any kind of sexual energy in a little while, and I want to cultivate that. Like, my mind is making the choice, not my body. And I want to cultivate that. Then I will watch some porn, or I will pull up ladycheeky.com, and I will find a handful of links that I find super sexy, and I'll send those to Alex. And then his response is actually what turns me on the most. So I might feel some desire in looking at those beautiful, sexy, erotic images. But what really, really ends up turning me on is his response to the images that I sent. So if he gets all growly and aroused, that then arouses me. And then I start feeling like, okay, I think my body's starting to rev itself up. So first I would ask you, how have you played with and experimented with triggering that sexual response in yourself? That just gives you a little more agency, a little more know-how about what might turn you on. So for instance, like, I know that looking at porn is going to turn me on, but my partner's response to things that I send him is going to be even more so. Right. So I understand the nuance of my arousal and the different ways that I get aroused. But coming back to your question, we are allowed to choose the circumstances that define our lives. There are a lot of people who may look at something like an arranged marriage in a culture where the wife doesn't have the freedom to survive on her own and make value judgments around that, right? But within the context of the culture that she's in and the choices that she has available to her, if she chooses to have sex that she doesn't really want because it's going to mean a healthier marriage and a healthier living environment for her, we have to be able to respect that context. Now, we can work on the larger global change, but within the smaller, more nuanced ways we all live our lives, we have to realize that everyone's bodies and needs work a little bit differently. And so I want to give you the permission to have the responsive desire that you have. I want you to give you permission that it's okay to say to your partner, I may really not feel like sex most of the time. And in fact, I usually only feel sexy when some type of stimulus has started. And if you give that permission to your partner to initiate with you and then to check in, right? So it's not, I'm going to start doing sexy things with you and just keep going no matter what, but I'm going to start doing sexy things with you, see if you start feeling sexy, and then we decide, do we move forward or not? Like, for me, that's a very complete, nuanced consent conversation. You're choosing to put yourself into the situation. You're offering an invitation to a partner to do these things, and then you check in with each other. I think that's a super valid way to have sex. And I think there's lots and lots and lots and lots of people out there who have sex that way. You know, I mean, there have been so many times that I haven't felt like having sex at all. But then after a 5 or a 10 minute massage and I'm starting to feel relaxed, I start feeling a little bit sexy, right? That's normal. That's how responsive desire works. As for explaining it to others, I really think that Emily's book is a great place to start just in giving language around that. I also don't think that you have to explain yourself, right? Now, if you want to invest in that conversation and you want to put that energy in, then this may just be a time where starting at the beginning is the option, because nuance around consent is still really difficult for a lot of people, even people in sex positive circles. But also just realize you don't have to explain yourself. It's perfectly valid for you to hear a consent conversation and to say, I actually experienced it a little bit differently, and I'm not feeling like I want to share, but I just want to offer that maybe people experience things a little bit differently. And leave it at that. So I hope that was helpful, left out. I want everyone listening to know that whether you have responsive desire or spontaneous desire, those things can shift and change depending on where you are in your life and your hormones and your health and the relationship status that you're in. So allow it to change and engage with it in a playful way. Also, just realize that like consent is a lot more than a yes or a no, especially inside of our intimate relationships where we can kind of explore those edges and that nuance a little bit more. It would be very different if you were meeting up with a stranger and they started pushing you for sex versus being with someone that really understands you and how you work. And so there's a lot more opportunity for communication to happen that's both verbal and nonverbal, right? So we have to be a little bit more explicit with folks that we don't know. And we can kind of bring in a little more nuance when we've started to establish that familiarity and intimacy. So I hope that was helpful. If anyone has any thoughts or stories along those lines that you want to share, please write in. Thank you so much, Left Out. The next email is actually a two-part email from someone named Desperately in Love. She wrote to me a couple of weeks ago and then wrote to me again about a week ago because the intensity of the situation had increased. And so I reached out to her and offered a couple of thoughts, and she actually wrote back with a really lovely update, but I want to just share this with everyone and we'll see where we end up. So the first email from Desperately in Love, the subject line says rape survivor, sex-starved girlfriend, and consent. Hello, I love the podcast. I'm learning so much. I just got done listening to your podcast on consent. My current boyfriend is 10 years older than me. I'm 26, and he has diabetes. He also is a rape survivor. He stated to me that sex makes him feel dirty, and he really has no interest in it. When we first got together, I took things slow with him, keeping in mind that he has a trauma past. I always reminded him that he could say no. We have now been dating 9 months. I know his diabetes has an effect on his sex drive and ability to perform sexually, but I also feel like his sexual trauma is a contributing factor to his lack of libido. We have had many conversations about this issue. He is willing to see a therapist, but they're so expensive and our insurance sucks, which kind of leaves us without any help. I'm the kind of person who could have sex 3 times a day and not be satisfied. He's the kind of person that could go years without it and be happy. I can't jill off enough to feel sexually satisfied. I am becoming more depressed and feeling like there must be something wrong with me for him to not want to fuck me. My boyfriend is about holding hands, and I'm about getting pounded from behind. My boyfriend is very vanilla, and I'm interested in BDSM. We've come to a compromise to perform some kind of sexual act every 2 weeks, but it still isn't enough for me, and I feel awful because I feel like I'm pressuring him, even though he says I'm not, and that he does it because he loves me. He has told me no matter what, he will never like sex, and that breaks my heart. I want to have sex with him all the time so that I can express how I love him and make him feel good. Because I do love him. Don, I really do love him. He is perfect in every other way. When I'm with him, he makes me feel like a princess. I feel so lucky. There is just this one thing in the way of us being complete as a couple. Am I being an asshole? Am I violating consent? Where do we go from here? Any advice would be appreciated. Thank you. You're amazing. Desperately in love. Then about a week later, I received this email. Desperately in love. Subject, trauma, sex therapy, and chronic illness. Hi, Don. I know you probably get tons of emails and haven't gotten a chance to get to mine yet. I wrote you about my boyfriend having diabetes, being raped, and not wanting to have sex with me. Well, since the holidays are here, he is meeting my family. I am half Mexican and half white. He is meeting the Mexican side of my family, and this is a huge deal in my culture. Like, borderline Beyonce, he better put a ring on it. With all the issues with our sex life and my own insecurities, I find myself trying to stifle my own sexuality. I am becoming more depressed. I have decided to start going to sex therapy. From what I have read, this therapist seems to be open-minded, which is hard to find in the Bible Belt of Texas. I asked my boyfriend if he would consider going with me, and he said, "We'll see," which usually means, "Stop talking about it. I don't want to go, but I don't want to hurt your feelings or make you mad." Dawn, I love this man. What if he refuses therapy? What if he isn't willing to face his trauma? Everybody says that sex and intimacy, without sex and intimacy, a relationship cannot survive. Am I setting myself up for failure? I'm terrified I keep wasting my time on trying to help people that don't want help. I'm a social worker, and I feel like I am in this alone. I feel like there is something about me that nobody can love. I'm sorry for bugging you and writing a novel. Thank you for all you do. Oh, there was so much in those two emails, and so I ended up writing privately back to her and just offering a couple of tidbits, and she actually wrote back with a really wonderful update, both about her boyfriend meeting her family and her therapist and all that. But I just kind of want to dig in a little bit to the two emails in case anybody else is struggling. The first thing that really stood out to me about the second email specifically was, I feel like there is something about me that nobody can love. And I thought that was a really powerful statement. So if we feel like we aren't lovable, and this is something that I have struggled with and still struggle with, like I really still struggle with this lovability narrative. And while it's something that's gotten better for me, it takes a lot of unpacking and a lot of work and a lot of feeling shitty. So I just want to say, like, I get that. When we feel like we're not lovable, sometimes we choose to stay in situations that aren't good fits because we're worried that no one else could possibly love us. So if this person does love us and there's a chance nobody else could, we cling to this person because we feel like this might be our only chance. Otherwise, we'll die lonely and alone and desperate. And, you know, those are the cultural stories at play too. We are told that if we're not partnered, then we're lonely and useless. And that's not at all the case, but that forms a really dangerous narrative for all of us. And sometimes we end up making choices that hurt ourselves or that hurt other people because we're so afraid of what the alternative is. Are you staying in this relationship because you're afraid that you're not going to find anyone else, that no one else could love you? And are you holding on to this individual because you're scared that it's the only option? So dealing with those insecurities in herself could free up a lot of space and also change the conversation so that the issues look different and offer a different lens. I also thought it was really interesting in the first email that she said, "I feel awful because I feel like I'm pressuring him, even though he says I'm not." It's so important for us to trust our partners when they offer us information, and also to make sure that we're creating a space where our partners can change their minds. And so that's a dance, right? Like all of things that come to relationships and comes with being in a relationship, right? It's a constant dance and a back and forth. That's part of what makes relationships amazing and part of what makes them so hard. If he says you're not pressuring him and that he's choosing to engage in sex because he loves you, you have to trust that. You have to trust a partner when they offer that for you. Because if you don't trust that, there's a bigger issue, and the constant questioning is actually going to create a lot of resentment and just degrade the relationship itself. So trust him. Now, it's okay to check in every couple months or, you know, a couple of times a year and just make sure he still feels that way, and or to just let him know, like, if at any point this starts feeling bad, I really want you to tell me. But then trust a partner when they say, like, this isn't something I would choose for myself, but I'm choosing to do it because I love you. That can be true of kink too, right? So you might be into, God, I don't know. You might be into furries and dressing up like animals, right? And that might be something you're super into. And your partner might be totally ambivalent about furries and not find them arousing at all. And just kind of like, yeah, you know, like, it's a thing. I get it. People do it, but it's not for me. If they choose to dress up and role play with you because you love it so much, that's a valid choice. Someone doesn't have to love something in order to choose to do it from a place that's like powerful, right? So if your boyfriend, desperately in love, is choosing to have sex with you because he knows it's important to you, that's a valid choice. And we have to respect that. We can't make him want to have sex. We can't make him love sex. We can't make him feel differently about sex. That's a journey that he has to go on for himself. Now, I agree with you. Trauma can have a significant impact on how we feel in our bodies and how we engage sexually. But he has to want to change that, and he has to want to go on that journey. So that's not something that you can do for him. Which brings me to my next question, which is, why do you love him? What about this relationship is powerful and important and makes you happy? We have a tendency in relationship to focus on all the things that aren't working and to make them really, really big, which makes all the things that are working feel really, really small. And so we have this very skewed, unhealthy view of relationships. And this can be true of like parents, siblings, people we're having sex with. But we all have this just like innate ability to zero in on the things that just make us so irritated and drive us up a wall or make us feel so broken. And then we minimize the thousands of other things that are going well. And so by really being able to articulate, like, these are the reasons I love this person, and these are the reasons why this relationship is important to me and feels good. And then to see that and see it's actually not a very long list. So why am I even in this relationship? Or it's a really, really long list. And maybe that offers some relief around the tension, right? Because a lot of being in relationship is also just realizing that change will happen, but sometimes we have to be patient with it. And then deciding if we want to be patient, because we don't have to be. The bottom line is, we can't change our partners. We can't make them want to face their traumas. We can't make them want sex more. And we have to decide, like, if a partner doesn't change, or if they change really slowly, can you still find a way to be happy and fulfilled with things the way that they are? And that can be a really powerful exercise to sit with, because the answer might be, no, I can't be happy and fulfilled with the things they are, the way things are. And then you have to make some decisions. But if you change the way that you're looking at it, you might find that you actually can be. There are a lot of different schools of thought when it comes to relationships, right? So some people, like Dan Savage is a great one. Dan Savage really feels like life is too short to stick with someone who's clearly not a good fit. So we should just end things as soon as possible and move on and find someone who's a better fit in all the categories. And then there are other people who think that when you find a relationship that feels good, if there's a couple of things that aren't working, that it can be really powerful and valuable to put in the time and the effort and the dedication to help things heal in that space, or to find new ways to connect in that space. But that can take a lot of time and energy. So you have to kind of decide which of those two camps feels best for you. And that might change based on each relationship. In one relationship, you might just feel like, oh, this is not worth it. I don't have the energy. And it might be because your life's too busy or because of the person. And there might be other times in your life with other people and other relationships when you really do want to put in that effort. I just want to offer to Desperately in Love that sometimes holding space and giving someone a chance to just settle in and feel really safe and curious can open them up to start examining the places where they're hurt and to start questioning the ways that they feel stuck, right? I've experienced this myself. Like, there are some things in my own life that feel very scary and very painful. And, you know, they, even now, they still hurt to even just think about. But the more that I feel the space to just let my process be at the pace and the speed that it is, the more I'm willing to ask those questions, the more I'm willing to dance towards my edges. If I was feeling forced, then I would go on lockdown, right? I'm not budging. I'm not moving. This is too scary. This is too hard. But we don't have to put in that effort with everyone. We get to choose whether or not we have the resources for that. So my question to you, Desperately in Love, is this relationship one where there's so many good things, and in this one space, things feel yucky? And can you create space and patience and curiosity and an invitation to just breathe into that discomfort? Or is this so painful and so misaligned and so mismatched that you need to make some hard decisions? So the other thing that I want to call out from her email is, she says, everybody says that without sex and intimacy, a relationship cannot survive. I disagree with that. And a lot of people will feel very strongly about this, and that's super okay, right? We all get to experience these things differently. But my perspective is that from asexuals to trauma survivors to folks who simply don't like sex to folks who have just ended up in a body where sex isn't that easy or fun or pleasurable, right? You can get your intimacy needs met and your pleasure needs met in a ton of different ways. Most people kind of think that sex is the way to make that happen. We've been told that like sex equals intimacy and sex equals pleasure, and that's like the fast track to intimacy and pleasure. But that's actually not the case. Like, it's not the only story. If you read Barbara Kourelis's book, Ecstasy is Necessary, you'll see that the entire book is about endless ways that we can experience actual ecstasy, and very few of them involve sex. So how can we nurture relationships that feel really good and nurturing for all parties? And if sex is something that's really important to you, then dig into why sex is important to you. And this is good for all of us to just think about. Why is sex so important? Is it because we think it's the only way that we can get our intimacy needs met? Is it because we feel like a partner owes us that kind of pleasure? Or is it because sex for us is a transcendent experience? It's a way to connect at a soul level. It really genuinely has meaning for you. And what are the other ways that you can cultivate intimacy, touch, and pleasure that don't involve sexual intercourse? Because there's going to be a point in all of our lives, if we're alive long enough, that we are going to have surgeries, illness, experience some type of disability, have so much stress that we just can't respond sexually to any situation, you know, right after birth or having a newborn or a family member's illness, right? So all of us are going to go through some type of experience, either once or many times or over a long period of time, when sex really may not be an option. Maybe you're on bed rest from your pregnancy. Maybe you just had heart surgery, you know, whatever it is. And if we do the work now, where we find all of these really yummy, delicious, connecting ways to experience intimacy with a partner, to nurture our erotic creativity, to have pleasure and touch and sensation in our lives that doesn't include sex, then we have all of these ways now to create connection with a partner. That's why a lot of people turn to kink. Maybe you have some type of vaginismus, or you have a yeast infection, a chronic yeast infection, or whatever it is, where like genital play is off the table. Kink can be a really fun way for people to still be in their bodies and feeling vulnerable and connected and having all this sensation And you can still have all your clothes on and be doing some really sexy impact play. I invite all of us to start thinking about this, because at some point in our lives, we're going to need to have this. And then we get to make choices from a place of knowledge rather than from a place of fear. So instead of feeling like maybe I should end this relationship because everyone says sex is important, instead examining why sex is important to you and what it means to you and other ways to get those same needs met, so that you can just have a little more space and permission to then really dig into, is this something I want to stay in? Is this something that works for me? And then now you're making decisions that are based on knowledge and understanding and spaciousness, instead of like fear and cultural ideals and everyone putting their expectations on us, which is where so much of this comes from. Desperately in Love did write back to me and said some really sweet things to me, but also said that he met the family at Christmas and they loved him. It made her heart super happy and she loves him so deeply. She explains why she loves him and it's really touching. She's been seeing this sex positive therapist and she's feeling really good about digging into her insecurities and understanding her needs and what her boundaries are, what she wants from a relationship. She was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder at 14, and for a long time after she stopped self-harming, she used risky sex as another form of self-harm and a destruction of self. And so she's starting to kind of unpack what's inside of her around sex and love and relationships. And she says she's very grateful. She's excited that she's asking these questions and doing these things because it's life-changing. And so I just want to say to you, Desperately in Love, thank you for being so brave to share yourself. And thank you for being so brave in asking tough questions. So many of us are so scared to even ask the questions that we just don't. We just move on. And so even to be able to ask the questions out loud and to examine those and then to start thinking differently, I think that's another thing, is sometimes we're willing to say, like, is sex important to us? And then we immediately say yes and kind of close down and we don't dig deeper. So the fact that you're open to changing and growing and working with a therapist, I think, is a really powerful thing. In the background, I can hear Alex making dinner, and whatever it is, it smells really, really good. And I definitely need another drink because it is New Year's Eve and we are treating ourselves to something super delicious tonight, along with some like naked Sudoku. So there you go. That's our wild New Year's Eve. I have one last question that's about butt stuff. Now, I know I just talked about butt stuff with Kate McCombs and Louise Boucher on the last episode, but I just thought this email was super, super sweet. And so I wanted to offer a response. Ryan wrote to me with a subject line of anal assistance or what's up my bum? Dawn, first, I wanted to say that I love the podcast. I found it during the summer just after my daughter was born, and listening for several hours a day kept me sane and sexual while nothing else was. Your advice, thoughts, and insights helped me understand the ups and downs that my sex life was going through, while helping my girlfriend deal with the body image and desire changes that typically come with giving birth, we have developed an open communication that I think you would be proud of. Now, the openness has led me to a really exciting place, our first anal toys for me. I am not completely new to anal play, and I've decided on a set of Jimmy Jane plug and prostate stimulator, but I would love a recommendation for a good vibrating one. Any thoughts or lube recommendations would help. I'm so excited to explore amazing sex with my wonderful partner, and I promise to let you know what kind of amazing fucking deliciousness comes from it. Best wishes for you and Alex, which is so sweet, Ryan. Oh my gosh, this warms my heart. I'm so excited. Yay for ups and downs and realizing that's normal and leaving space for that and giving yourself permission to have these amazing conversations, as awkward and weird as they might be, and anal toys for you. I love it. So the first thing that came to mind for a vibrating anal toy, and there are lots of different ones on the market, but I've seen a number of my sex educator friends highly recommend this one. It's called the B, letter B, vibe, and there's a dash. So it's B-vibe, remote control, vibrating, rimming butt plug. Now, this is a silicone butt plug that is remote operated, so it can be for shared play, which is amazing. And it's literally a butt plug, but in the thin part of the plug that sits right at the rim of your anus, right where all of that sensation is, right? There's actually a whole bunch of beads that rotate under the silicone. So it feels like rimming, is what people say. It has pretty good reviews, and I've seen a couple of people mention how much they love it. It's a little bit pricey. I've seen it retail from like $120 to $150, but, you know, it's also a really high-quality vibrating butt plug with a remote control. So if you're ready to invest, that can be something really fun. There are also a couple of other vibrating anal toys out there that you can find at any of the big feminist sex toy shops, so like Self Serve or Shebop or Smitten Kitten. They do online sales, so it's worth just popping over. But I think this B-Vibe remote control butt plug might be a great place to start. Now, my favorite lube for anal is Uber Lube. It's a silicone-based lube, really high quality. It lasts forever. I use it for all my butt stuff. The only thing is, silicone lubes and silicone toys don't always play well together. You need to spot check it. So just keep in mind that if you're getting a silicone toy, like the B-Vibe, and you're getting a lube, like Uber Lube, you'll want to make sure you do a little spot check on the base or on a part that's not going in your body, just to make sure they don't react. And a reaction for silicone on silicone that's bad will feel sticky. If it's a high quality silicone lube and a high quality silicone toy, sometimes they won't react and it'll be nice and slippery. You can also put a condom over your toys, takes care of that. If you want a water-based lube, Slickwid Sassy Gel is a really thick gel water-based lubricant. That can also be really great for anal. So something like that. And they also have Slickwid has a silicone-based lube too that you can check out. But their Sassy Gel is also one that I have. So invest in a high-quality lube. Enjoy that new Jimmy Jane plug and prostate stimulator. And decide how much of an investment you want to make in a good vibrating one. But be sure, if you don't want to invest in the B-Vibe because, you know, $130, $150 is too much, I've definitely seen ones that are more like the $80 range. I remember seeing one that I think was called Cheeky Boy. That was a prostate stimulator that vibrates. And Fun Factory also has one that's called Duke. And I think the Cheeky Boy is like $80-ish and the Duke is around $100. The Duke is a prostate stimulator with a handle that also takes a vibrator that you can insert. I don't know if it comes with a vibrator. You might have to buy a little bullet separately because Fun Factory makes this little bullet. But any of the sex positive shops out there are probably going to have this. So check it out and see if you can find something you like. And Ryan, I love everything about your email. Butt play and communication and helping your girlfriend through everything that comes with giving birth and allowing for all that growth and change. And holy crap, look at where you are now, getting all that butt love. Thank you so much for listening. That was a really fun meal to get. All right, so we are at the end of our hour. It is New Year's Day when this comes out. I hope all of you had super fun, sexy New Year's Eves, whether that was staying in and going to bed early or going out and partying it up. I also want your confessions. So January, that means up through mid-January, I'm accepting submissions from you on your firsts. So call, email me a file or write it out and send it to me and I'll read it on your behalf. But I want your stories and your voices as part of this podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Dawn Sarah. You can go to sexgetsreal.com to learn more or to send me a message, and I will talk to you next week.